You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And believe it or not, it is September 1st, 2021. A few days ago, I was on a podcast, Zoltan News, HN or something like that, on YouTube. And these are young guys who are very literate. And their rarities, I think. And they had me on. It was one of the better conversations I've had. But there's a lot of these podcasts that are very good. And one of the things that came up, there were a lot of questions that were coming in, actually was flooded with them, was on Ivan Ilin, who shows up in the American media trying to tie him to Vladimir Putin, which is unsuccessful, to say the least. Same thing for Dugin. The connections among them are minimal, especially since Ilin was a emigre philosopher who died in the 1950s. And, of course, Dugin exists on a completely different intellectual plane than any actual politician. But they wouldn't know that. They don't know that. So it's been a long time since I've dealt with Ilin on this show. And, God, it's been years. And it's a shame that I've only dealt with him once. And I want to focus on the more, I mean, we did the more abstract things the last time. This time, given our present situation, I want to talk about the more practical elements of this, because he is an emigre writer, in the sense that he was an exile from the Soviet Union who was living in a very, very precarious existence. He is he was both a nationalist and a monarchist. Very little of his work exists in English. What makes him interesting to me is that he's one of the few to understand Hegel as a nationalist and royalist writer, which of course he was. Edmund Burke, gets this conservative label, despite really not being a philosopher at all. But Hegel put that sort of thing on a far more rational basis. You don't have to understand the metaphysics and the phenomenology to understand his philosophy of right. I did my master's thesis on that, and it's been with me ever since. It's not the easiest book to get through, but you don't have to some extent, you don't have to grasp the metaphysics to get the good out of that book. However, he does have his own vocabulary. He's like Heidegger in that sense. And because few people know anything about the guy, very little is in English, they could tie him to whoever they want. They could call names. They could talk about these nefarious and vague ties to different people in different groups. But significantly, he's one of these guys who split the difference between Hegel on the one side and the Russian experience on the other. And his work on Hegel, which I, of course, it only exists in Russian, is one of the best I've ever come across. And it's changed for people who know. It's changed minds on what Hegel is, and I've dealt with that elsewhere. There's a series of essays that he put together in late August of 1951 called Our Tasks. And some of these articles, depending on what edition you have, are, you know, on formal democracy, foundations of democracy, on aristocracy, the fanatics for the social contract, even something as practical as voting. And those are some of the essays I want to be drawing from here, because it's one thing to lay out a criticism of the existing regime. It's one thing, when the Soviet Union, of course, is an easy target at the time. The emigres didn't speak much English. They didn't make much headway in the English-speaking world, and they never liked each other. The big split between Ukrainians and Russians, it really was a disaster. They didn't have the influence that they could have had. And since they knew the Russian situation extremely well, it was a resource that no one ever took advantage of. In fact, they were considered enemies of the American system, which of course they were. But allegedly there was a Cold War going on, but no one ever told the FBI that. So I'm titling this Democracy and Evil, 1949, the mid-50s. His mature writing, because the two things go together. Now, when he used the American word democracy, doesn't mean anything. Like all political words, you know, in popular debate, deliberately uses words that have no meaning, or it has a secret meaning. You know, democracy just means liberal ideology. At best, it refers to some kind of a set of procedures for registering opinion, which it now has been rejected officially by the system. But he's using it to refer to representative government. We all know that liberal democracy never leads to any kind of serious representation. It's just a cover for oligarchy or worse. Representative government is another matter. And in his works on the democratic system, both positive and negative, he makes a well-known distinction, the organic version and the mechanical version. Everything in the liberal West is based on mechanism, the science, all the assumptions. Nominalism is based on it, although mechanism is actually a universal. But again, I don't think they ever were told that. And it's the official ideology. It's purely quantitative. And Dugin says the same kind of thing. The mechanical view, the political system in general, sees society as purely atomized. These are isolated individuals with its own somehow idiosyncratic desires, although of course no one knows where those come from. They seek pleasure over all things. They're really utilitarians. And their motives are assumed to be money and some kind of sexual release. That's the animal level that they exist in. And of course, over time, it wasn't always the case, but over time it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Allegedly, the ideology of mass society, which is mechanistic itself, claims that they do have some kind of an effect on the political system. They're the products of the political system. You know, when the peasantry was driven into the cities, they lost all of their connections with the countryside. The assumption, of course, and there's no justification for it, even in their own system, is that every human being somehow is born free and equal. No one actually believes that to be the case. People are born completely dependent of varying abilities, varying circumstances, which makes any abstraction concerning them impossible. But it assumes this as a way to cover over the fact that most people don't matter. History is made, no matter what political system you have, by determined and fanatical minorities. The masses, as Nietzsche would say, are just along for the ride. They don't matter. And they think whatever system they live under has always been the case. And even worse, they live under the fiction that the majority of votes has some connection with the makeup of the state and the makeup of policy. Now, I'm pretty sure no one really believes that anymore, but it's an assumption that people have to make to keep the system going. Remember, a lot of people believe this stuff not because they could ever defend it, not because they want to defend it, they don't even know the vocabulary to defend it, but unless they do, their entire worldview is going to come apart. And that's never a good thing, because it means they would, you know, it's bad for business. So the assumption is this free and equal birth, and therefore their reason is identical, their access to logic is identical, their education should be identical, and their political standing should be identical. The problem is these ideologies don't start with any kind of state of nature. That's a thought experiment. All of these start with existing societies where there's already extreme levels of inequality. So in the Russian case, you already had a system existing that was based on oligarchy, a specific ethnic oligarchy. And therefore, the imposition of liberalism just meant those who already had power now had a cover under which to accumulate more. So even worse than that, the mechanistic liberal view assumes, and of course this may be changing over the last 2 or 3 years, the citizen is considered in advance, as he would say, to be reasonable, to be well-meaning and incorruptible. Politicians and businessmen are corrupt, but not the average voter. And liberal democracy is based on the idea that if they're just given enough opportunities and enough education, which is sort of what censorship is based on, this well-meaning demeanor will be exposed. And the only people who don't fit that bill are people who are criminals. But as Elin says, most people are in fact criminals. They just haven't gotten caught yet. The hatred of the elite has more to do with jealousy, that they wish they could have that kind of power. And if granted it, they would use it probably more violently than the people who possess it. The assumption that people are, especially political elites, are looking for power only works for the sociopath. For an ordinary person, power is always a bad thing. For most people, power, you run from it. They come up with every excuse. They blame others for any failing. But freedom, in the normal sense, assumes that you have to take full responsibility for what happens. So the desire, apparently, is power, just without any resulting responsibility. The theory, of course, is that the state, and people actually believe this today, is just, he says, a mirror or arithmetic sum of previous elections, and that has an immediate connection on policy. It's a dogma. It's almost a religious assumption. It's not even an axiom, because if you question anyone for more than 30 seconds, they're going to have to deny it, which means that the entire system has no meaning. So in essence, he says that the average citizen is granted the freedom of insincere, deceitful, insidious, insinuating speech, and ambiguous, calculating suppression of the truth. He is given the freedom to believe liars and scoundrels. Because ultimately, in order for anyone to have any kind of power in this system, it's automatically illegitimate. That means I have to manipulate others into accepting them. So the state somehow has this obligation to protect their freedom to be irrational. So freedom as a matter of formality, as he would say, is a freedom of betrayal and overt destruction. Because there's no difference between that and any constructive work, so long as enough people accept it. The only thing that matters is mechanical and arithmetic sums of previous election. No one, of course, believes that. And I think Elin starts to believe this as an actual fact, and even Ortega did as well, that this actually exists. These people are products only. They're completely inert. They don't have any motive force. I mentioned before the Dugin's idea of the political party and even the founding generation's idea of a faction has absolutely nothing to do with any kind of common good. In fact, it institutionalizes the very opposite. This is pure Machiavellianism. They cannot moderate their demands. And given the sheer number of politicians and the non-state actors controlling them, the average elected official has absolutely no power. So formal democracy, in other words, doesn't permit the doubting of good intentions, despite the fact that no one actually believes it. I mean, you know, Locke and Rousseau, to greater or lesser degrees, believed that humanity was reasonable and kind. The only thing that they lack is freedom. But even Thomas Hobbes, who was the founder of modernity, believed human beings are simply rational in the mechanistic sense. And the only reason that they get violent is that they constantly have to respond to others seeking power over them. So from there, he deals with the concept of the right to vote, which is not taken very seriously because anyone can have it, including those who are in this country illegally. The last few elections, no one takes this seriously. No one trusts the system of elections and the mythology about the, you know, alleged foreign influence. You had neocons talking about Iranian and Chinese influence on the one hand, and of course the far better known Russian influence on the other. But he defines the right to vote as the recognition of the power of judgment and the power of decision in public affairs. But that's a tall order. Very few people actually have that level of command. You have to have a full understanding, a coherent understanding of what the state is. A law, freedom, justice, honor, conscience, homeland, a tradition, spirit, culture, etc. in some detail. This is why in the founding generation in America, you had maybe between 4 and 7% of the population given this authority to vote. Votes actually meant something because the people who were casting them were far more independent, far less dependent on major media and concentrated capital pressure on them. That was the very definition of freedom, the freedom as autonomy. Now, the last time I spoke about Ilin, I dealt with this idea of freedom. And I said that the freedom in the Western world today has absolutely been butchered and redefined so badly that it actually means the opposite of what it was supposed to mean. The word freedom is purely abstract. What really matters would be independence or autonomy. So given everything that Ilin says and Solzhenitsyn says, it's well known now that freedom is perverted and defined in such a way that it's simply the freedom to act arbitrarily. There's no intrinsic end to it. There's no virtue attached to it. Autonomy is a different story. Because Ilin, Solzhenitsyn, refer to it as the lack of internal restraint. And there we're talking about, you know, appetites, self-interest, egocentrism. So it's not just the freedom from external restraint, but the freedom from appetites and vices. Things, as I said, that distort our perceptions of the world around us. Because what these passions do is they project themselves onto the world. Our internal state dictates what we perceive, which is one thing that psychology does make a lot of sense out of, except that in the economic and in the political arena, that's not accepted. I also said that that's identical to self-government. Self-government isn't just formal independence, but how people in government are supposed to behave and function. Self-government is the same thing as personal independence. There's nothing internally driving you to do things. Your motivation is intrinsic, not extrinsic. You use the word passion all the time as something negative because it's connected with the word passive. It's something that happens to you. You're not in control of it. It controls you. So the concept of freedom I've mentioned this many times in the past, and with Ilyin and many others, that freedom is fully consistent with being driven by the love of power and lusts of all kinds, whatever else. So long as there's no external restraint, you could do as you please. And that's the difference. So, of course, he believes in a certain level of aristocracy, as the founding fathers did. They all did. Very few people believed in mass democracy until the Progressive Era, to some extent, or maybe even Reconstruction. But then you'll be challenged as to who could possibly decide who would have this level of command and who doesn't. And Ilyin gets very sarcastic in his response. And he says, well, you know, we'll pretend that they do. We know that they don't understand anything. We'll pretend that he understands all of this and that his judgment means something. And he says that this pretense is absolutely impossible anywhere else. Any of the crafts in medicine, in any technical field, because that kind of mentality in any other field will lead to complete destruction. The inept ignoramuses trying to fly an airplane, trains derailing, cars overturning, sick people will die. However, that goes out the window where politics is concerned. Ilyin says this in his concept of voting in this same collection. And I'm translating this as I'm reading it. It is nothing that a person is asked about the good of the state. It doesn't matter that a person's asked about the good of the state. The only thing he says is the benefits of his own pocket and the benefits of his group or class, his faction. He was given the right to judge law, and he helped organize power centers that are good only for lobbying, putting pressure on everyone else. He may have been entrusted to observe, to oversee creativity and creative work, but he rather preferred to sell it to oligarchs for bread and for circuses. He was asked about justice, and he only proclaimed a vulgar equality, the greatest injustice and the greatest violence you can imagine. Questions of honor, conscience, faith, and the rest, he proclaimed the opposite. Dishonor, freedom from conscience, and the persecution of those around him. That was loose translation. That's how he answers it. And all of this, the upshot, the punchline of all of this, is that the totalitarian system that he's talking about, because this is in the middle of the Soviet era, but anywhere that that's been, especially a leftist version, right doesn't have totalitarianism. They have authoritarianism in the vulgar definition of the word. Totalism is strictly on the left, but it's not an accidental phenomenon. This is what happens when quality gives way to quantity. Qualitative decline, as he says, and spiritual degeneration that liberal democracy brings. Whenever you stress quantity, in other words, numbers, votes, income, that's the sole measure of people. Quality, how these things might be used, the virtue of these people, is then reduced. It's a hypocritical pretense that there are these issues of virtue and judgment that come from nowhere. And we have to assume that every voter and every citizen has this. And he gave himself into what Ilyin calls the political rabble. And they went for the demagogues and charlatans. Now, I'm going to quote him again here. Usually, and I'm saying this myself, usually when you say the word rabble, you're talking about a mob. Don't consider the stereotype of a mob out in the street with torches. Here's what he says about it. When I discuss the rabble, I'm not just talking about the peasantry or agricultural or ignorant people, not with poverty, not with the ignorant necessarily, but with baseness of the soul. This baseness can be found at every social level, every class, especially in our time. When the educated and semi-educated rabble has appeared, the nobility of the soul lives and is often found in peasant labor. People of evil and vicious will belong to the rabble. People without honor or conscience, people with a dead moral and social concept. Rapacious, people with no principle, people of what he calls the vicious professions. And certainly he means banking and the rest. So when he refers to rabble or mob rule, he's not just talking to talking about people in the street. He's talking about this particular mentality. He's talking a qualitative state of the soul. So then he imagines a debate with someone who's trying to refute that. And essentially, he imagines his opponent saying, you can't deprive people of these political rights based on these kind of vague qualitative ideas. You need to have a legal, firm ground to distinguish rabble from non-rabble. Because no one in public is going to say that we think vicious people should be running things. Then he says this, and this is how he would answer that kind of response. Other people will say, well, you know, what's the criteria that we're going to use to decide one group of people to another? How do you decide who's an aristocrat and who's a member of the rabble? And he responds, and I've responded to something like this before. And this is a direct quote. He says, you're like a person who would say, since I don't know how to distinguish a rat carrying the plague from a normal rat, I propose to give freedom to all rats because I can't tell the difference. I don't know the reliable formal signs of diphtheria bacteria, so I reject all disinfection. My son who fell ill with the disease, I'm not even going to treat him. I'm afraid to upset not only the bad bacillus, but also some innocent bacterium. Let us proclaim the freedom and equality of all bacteria. In other words, the very fact that it's a difficult question doesn't imply that, therefore, there are no standards. It's one of these really bad fallacies that you get all the time when you're criticizing this sort of thing. They usually personalize it. They'll say, well, how can you possibly tell? And who are you to say one way or the other? And, of course, the answer is that's simply not relevant. The mere fact that it is a difficult question and is very difficult and you're going to make mistakes doesn't imply that the distinctions don't exist. So then he continues in this sarcastic response to these people. He says, well, since we don't know how to recognize who is blind and who can see in politics, then there must be no need to investigate at all. Everyone, we assume, is being able to see and surrender to the will of fate. Somehow everything is going to be settled. Let's not go deep into the question of physical vision. We still don't know anything. Better put the blind to run steam locomotives and airplanes and cars and entrust them with the art of painting and the business of artillery, because we all know that they have good intentions. And it is a rational response to the complete fallacy of claiming that's a very difficult matter and mistakes have been made in the past, therefore those standards don't exist. But no one can deny that even 50, 80 years ago, the nature of political debate was infinitely superior than anything you have now. Most people can't read the Federalist Papers, but at the time it was in a popular newspaper. In the 20th century, he says, the state has mastered such a level of technical and chemical and psychological power. It makes it a very dangerous repressive force. The totalitarian state has every level of technology. Actual totalism refers to the fact that every aspect of life is politicized. And you have that in America today, where there's not a move you can make that doesn't have a court case defining it. The sheer volume of laws means that everything, even minor actions you may take, has legal regulations on it. You could be sued for anything. So that kind of system, armed with the technology and power that it has, in the wrong hands, is going to lead to, 2021. It's going to lead to ignorance such that millions of people can die and are dying. Because you claim that there are no standards, because it's very hard to tell an aristocrat from a non-aristocrat, automatically you go to the lowest common denominator. what he calls the irresponsible adventurers. Power devolves into the hands of people who love power, to fanatical party hacks. And, you know, so anyone, people who win a civil war are usually not the best people. They're the most devious and violent and sociopathic people. Again, writing in the early 50s, he determines that there's three specific trends in political life, especially in Europe and in North America. And the first thing he noticed is that there's a development towards conspiracies and coups. This is because the legal locus of authority has been dispersed. You don't have a monarch. Therefore, power gets dispersed amongst individual politicians, and politicians are controlled by those with money. And he refers, of course, to the communists, who worked out a whole practical doctrine of exterminating large numbers of people. Everything is based on the conspiracy of the powerful. That's what the powerful do. That's how they got that way. And when that becomes the norm, automatically the most sociopathic elements are going to take power. The people who have no morals, who have no understanding, who only know Machiavellianism. The perverse, the traitors, the corrupt, the sadists. And that, you know, they're the underground schools, the leftist academies the world over, including universities, have been churning these people out by the ton. The second thing he notices are private sector pressure groups. Now, he says trade unions, but he doesn't just mean labor unions. He's referring to any organized pressure group connected to a specific interest, engaging in whatever methods serve their interests at the moment. Now, he does mention labor in the sense that he's talking about the early years of the Bolshevik Revolution. These people were lied to. They believed that somehow the Bolsheviks had the right to do what they did and were able to stop transport. They were able to stop a movement of food and everything. And whoever controls these groups can control the movement of anything. He's not just talking about labor. He's talking about finance. He's talking about these groups who serve their own interests and never the common one, which is what a monarchy is supposed to do in the very broad sense. So what was even a theory of a majority understanding now has been taken over. And he said, he's saying this in 1951, the conspiracy of the initiative minority. And that they have mastered what he calls the techniques of conspiracy, and the nature of the coup, which were perfected really in 1918, from 1918 to 1921. So what was natural law and the common good ends up being the will to power. And the only thing that really matters is the extent which they can fool enough people into serving them. The third thing is sort of what I mentioned before. The nature of the state on the surface seems very powerful. But because standards don't exist, because education doesn't exist, because the worst possible people are able to take over and often do it secretly, any conspiracy at any time, no matter who it is, as he says, can break into this politically weak and empty space. Whatever group has the most money or media control is able to simply take over when you don't have standards to begin with. If all you care about is self-interest, there's no way to judge one faction from another. If self-interest is all that matters, if the right to pursue your what you call happiness is the only thing that makes any difference politically, then you have no right to complain when your enemies take over and treat you very poorly. You would have done the exact same thing if you were victorious. That when standards and qualitative virtues have decayed, standards don't exist, aristocracy is held in contempt, or even misunderstood entirely. You see what happened in the Bolshevik Revolution. They take advantage of an increasingly dispersed society, where the liberals and leftists had been gradually rotting it out from within. And therefore, when World War I hit, the buttresses were kicked out. Now, I think he goes a little too far in that sense. The overwhelming majority of the population did not support the Reds. They were really a tiny secret faction. However, it does beg the question, though, how did a tiny secret faction, I don't care how much money they had, was able to take over with relative rapidity. When the public arena is rotted out without standards, it's very easy for any conspiracy to take over. And one of the things that he blames for this is a social contract. Most people are aware of this concept. It's, you know, political philosophy 101. Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau developed the idea of the state of nature, the circumstance before there was any civilization, language, religion, any real kind of interaction, which, of course, is an impossible, inconceivable idea. Society then comes from this chaos, chaos in all senses of the word, because people get together and for whatever reason decide that there needs to be a new form of state, and they all get together and draw up a contract, and the state comes into existence. Which, you know, when you put it like that, of course, when you read these guys, it sounds perfectly reasonable, but of course it's laughable. Depends on how you state it. It's a fiction. It's a presumption that justifies the ruling class of the day. No one actually believes in it. No one believes that there's any kind of agreement where they would even know under those circumstances what an agreement is. People in the state of nature don't have language. They don't have customs. How could they possibly know what a social contract is or any kind of a contract is? Of course, it's a fiction. It tries to create consent by saying in some primordial period of time, your ancestors consented to this form of rule. And it isn't that bad. But, of course, it simply doesn't exist. It's one of the most Machiavellian ideas imaginable. And the fact that his people bought it. But if such a contract existed, that would mean at any time that we could withdraw from the present society, either as individuals or as regions, societies and empires. But there's no constitution in existence that will allow that to happen. The American Civil War put that to rest. There was no voluntary agreement of states, according to them. There's no contract whatsoever. It is a unilateral regime, a unitary regime, acting on its own accord. Therefore, people who claim to believe in the social contract actually don't. At best, it's kind of a thought experiment you can use to judge a certain society at a certain time, but when the thought experiment is based on a ridiculous presumption, even that doesn't work. And yet, modernity, politically speaking, is based on it entirely. So, if any kind of representative government, and I don't like using the word democracy because it's so vulgar today, representation is something that really no one rejects. Liberal democracy has no connection with representation, but it's assumed to have one. But he does want to know what the fundamental mentality of a society has to be in order to have a serious or approaching a representative state. What are the foundations? What are the social virtues you have to have? And you know, Tocqueville talked about the spirit of the people, the spirit of the laws, or Montesquieu. In the sense of justice and the social order. And without these things, that no representation could ever exist, because it wouldn't even be recognizable. Representing what? What virtues are being represented? Is it just fleeting self-interest? And who defines that? The same people who will tell you that we have no idea what standards are and it's too difficult to tell are the same people that will say that enough people vote, we're going to get a representative system with no mechanism in between, because mechanism is not the issue here. The first thing he notes, and they have to have a confident sense of responsibility, meaning that, and he quotes directly, the fate of my people, my state, my family, children, grandchildren, depends on what I do and how I behave, politically and otherwise. I must do all of this according to honor and conscience. And he actually is quoting this hypothetical person in here, setting up this laborious connection between the family and the state, between the individual and the family. There's a connection between God, the homeland, and conscience. the honor, integrity in future generations. Without this sense of intergenerational responsibility, you can't have any kind of representative state. There is no rule of the people in broad sense without that. Without standards, without virtues, people will behave according to self-interest. They'll behave irresponsibly. And what takes its place is not just armed desire, but ideologies that come into existence to justify it, and that sound very good, but actually say very little. The second thing is a basic sense of loyalty and honesty. Without honoring law and voluntarily observing it, in other words, the only reason that you follow anything is because you're going to be sent to prison. If you don't, we'll never respect any kind of state structure, any kind of law, good, bad, or indifferent. This is where black markets come from. This is where organized crime comes from. These people are incapable of any kind of self-control or any kind of justice. And the only thing that matters is coercion. Edmund Burke did say that the less control people have internally, the more control they're going to need externally. And because of that, coercion is going to become the norm. It's clear, though, and Burke also said, to the extent, and Russell Kirk said this too, the more violence and threats that a country has to use in its day-to-day life, the less legitimate it is. He goes further, and he says that even if the laws were good, these people would never follow it because they don't know what the difference between good and bad are in this sense. They have no clue. The difference between yours and mine, between what's mine and what's the public's, what's mine and government. These are laws. These distinctions don't exist for them. And that's at the foundation of theft and venality and bribery. Not just being introduced into social life, but becoming institutionalized completely. To the extent where they're not ashamed of their criminality anymore. The third thing is what he calls a state political outlook. He wants to correspond that to the size of the country, the sovereign tasks of the nation. Some countries are smaller than others, larger than others, easier to invade than others. Russia being very vulnerable required a very different kind of mentality than 18th century America, who, had two oceans separating them from any major power. So people who are unaware of their status and the specific task of whatever nation they belong to can't possibly have any kind of representative system whatsoever. He calls it a pitiful caricature of democracy and destroy themselves. And this really shouldn't have to be said, but the fourth thing is there has to be a certain amount of knowledge, independent thought, about who they are. The level of popular ignorance means representative government is absolutely impossible because they wouldn't even know how to articulate what that would mean. We know the American lack of command over history or geography. Politicians who couldn't find Iraq on a map. Right in Congress, right on debate shows, they didn't know where the Balkans were, for example. There's hundreds of examples of this. They don't understand how economics works. They don't understand how interest rates work. They don't understand these basic things, what currency, where currency comes from, what money is, what foreign exchange means. The average voter does not understand. Therefore, if that's the case, then every demagogue will be able to get a hold of them. Fraud is real easy with an ignorant population. Those scammers that call and email people claiming that their computer is going to seize up unless they give them their credit card number. That only works on people who don't know anything about computers or are so ignorant about how people behave that they fall for it. Someone's falling for it because they keep doing it. Politically, you have to have a fairly, not an expert understanding necessarily, but a pretty detailed understanding of the interests, the history, the intentions, the founding of whatever country you're a part of. Otherwise, you're politically, as he says, blind and deaf, like a child, in matters of culture and silence, complete incompetence. This is where ignorant reporters, who themselves know absolutely nothing, can constantly dictate what is real and what isn't to people who doesn't know any better. Education is not this mass conveyor belt of standardized information. That is not the definition of what education is. It's very easy to sell votes when you don't know what a vote is. Finally, representation is based on the idea of personal integrity. Someone who doesn't understand, someone who doesn't have a voice, someone who doesn't know how to articulate, someone without self-esteem, someone who's raised to hate his own people, will sell his vote immediately. He doesn't think his vote's worth anything anyway. It wasn't that long ago where off-year, I think it's even now, off-year elections, back in the 90s, it was something like 20% of the electorate, which is fine by me. And there, it doesn't affect, you know, media control or anything. But there was talk, back in the late, under the Clinton administration, there was talk about making people vote. There are a few countries that force voting. You get fines if you don't. And which, of course, is laughable. That's the assumption that everyone has the same understanding of things and the same level of virtue. A people without character, as he said, will quickly disintegrate. War of all against all. One of the things that Rousseau said that made a lot of sense was that the state of nature idea was backwards. People were kind in his version of the state of nature. They got along with one with another. Institutions didn't exist. But it didn't matter. There weren't that many of them. They got by. When property was introduced, he doesn't explain how that happened. When, I guess, you know, natural disasters, I guess, things like that, but not in any specific sense. You had the Lockean system. You start having conflict over boundaries, the development of currency. When that gets bad, you know, Locke's whole situation was, you know, people can't be judging in their own case. That's the recipe for war. Therefore, some kind of representative government is necessary, at least amongst property owners. But in his case, it actually was everyone. It depends on what Locke you're reading. But you get to Hobbes only when that goes out of control. And everything decays into pure all against all. And this is one of the reasons that Rousseau rejected the modern project. His early work condemns the Enlightenment. Rousseau is an extremely complex figure that way. He's considered the father of the French Revolution, despite the fact that no French revolutionary ever used that kind of insight. There was the apogee of modernism, which is something that Rousseau condemned. The notion of the general will may have been used in rhetoric, but there was no conception of that in the revolutionary ideology. But even beyond that, those are five basic virtues or sets of virtues that have to exist for any kind of representative government to even have any hope for it, to even the potential for that kind of thing. But there are also social foundations, three of them. Social foundations is to be settled, have a home and a small amount of property, have a family, to have respect for labor. Without that, he becomes what Marx called a proletarian. A proletarian is not just someone who works for a living. A proletarian is someone who has nothing else but his labor. He doesn't own anything. Even his tools are owned by the owner of the factory. That, of course, is the case in America, where most people's debt is far higher than their assets. And assets are disappearing into, you know, fewer and fewer hands anyway. Since private sector debt is somewhere about $20 trillion, outside of a handful of oligarchs, no one actually owns anything. People have been told that having a mortgage means that you own your house. It isn't true. The bank has paid for this. Now the bank is demanding repayment with interest. They own it. And it says right on the deed, they own it. You live there to the extent you pay taxes and pay them. So most Americans are, in fact, proletarians. The whole paycheck-to-paycheck idea means that they don't own anything. They may possess things. They may have the illusion of owning things, but they actually don't. Their debt is extremely high. So having a proletarian population means that they can't be trusted. They're desperate. They're constantly worried and working and engaging in often destructive pastimes. They're in no position to talk about the niceties of political virtues. The second thing is that this autonomy, what he calls civic courage. It's Thomas Jefferson's, really the founding generation's idea of who couldn't be a citizen. The only person who could be a citizen is someone who is not dependent on someone else for their livelihood. You can't be dependent on the state, on Social Security, on a boss, on media, on people who control you socially, even if you don't recognize it, and have any right to say much of anything. You have no idea if what you're saying comes from you or comes from someone else. And most people really don't know the difference. You know, in Russia before the revolution, the peasantry owned the land they lived on. About 95%, in fact, did. When there was any kind of a substantial middle class. But debt reaches a point because, post-war economy is based on debt. They can't last very long. Liberal democracy initially had its support on these demagogues whipping up the ideology of the indebted. That's where he says that strata has democracy has its main support. It's a mob controlled by the wealthy. He says an impoverished people, having sunk to the state of rabble, will quickly degenerate and destroy any rule of justice. They're rabble. They're not people in the sense that they're not rational or free. To be free is to be rational by definition. You can't be rational without being free because reason would simply have no reason to exist. And thirdly, the question of national solidarity. And he's mentioned this elsewhere. The sense of mutual cooperation, Hegel's idea, the development of the free market leads people to believe that over time, their personal interest means that they have to recognize the interests of others. It's a system of production, not just their own self-interest. That's actually a contradiction. We're dependent. We're badly dependent on everything. We don't build our own homes. We don't deliver our own mail. We're radically dependent on each other, completely. Any claim to independence is laughable. We actually are completely dependent. Rational people will eventually realize that therefore we form a nation. We depend on each other. We're not individuals in any meaningful sense. But we have a prejudice that somehow, despite everything being done for us, except our own little job, we're still independent. It's nothing more than a prejudice. Most of this stuff is based on prejudice. You can't talk about representation when you believe that your self-interest is the only thing that matters. And self-interest can mean anything, any passion. It could be anything from jealousy to your class interest. You like labels, you only vote for Republicans, that kind of thing. So socially speaking, those are the three things that are necessary. But the other five is the fundament of what any kind of representation. Without those things, you can't have any justice. And what will happen is that the massive laws in court cases and a complete rationalization and legalization of every move you make is all that's left. Because there are no standards. Today, there is no private life. Everything you do has a legal foundation. There is nothing that isn't regulated by the courts or the state. And all of this leads to the concept of evil, which he started writing, I believe, in 1949. It's not from that same collection. And evil is based on delusion. Evil never shows itself this way. most of us are unaware. I mean, some of us, unfortunately, are aware. But the mass has no idea what evil really is. They can't comprehend how people can act the way that they do. And what eventually happens is that they believe that they're powerless. They don't know. They say, well, I can't judge anybody else. And they pretend that that settles the issue. We don't have to worry about it anymore. Believing that we can't judge anyone and God will take care of everything is an excuse for inaction. It's an excuse for lethargy, for abulia. No one actually believes that. But when you have nowhere, when you have no ideas, when you don't know what to do or where to go, that's what you end up with. And that's exactly what evil needs to thrive. As he says, militant evil perfectly knows our blindness and helplessness and develops the most skillful camouflage he can imagine. And usually he doesn't even need that. He simply called himself a different name and speak in high phrases. Here's from his work on evil. He says, a childish gullibility still lives in us. He's talking about the population as a whole. This naive presumption that if someone says something, he must really think that. If he promises you something, he wants to fulfill it. If he talks about his past, he's not making it up. If he develops plans and talks about them, he's actually taking that seriously. If he accuses someone of something, he's not engaging in slander. If he praises someone, it's not because he was threatened or promised or paid. If he claims to be a patriot, he cannot be a part of any counterintelligence service or fraud. If he utters any kind of sacred word for the sake of provocation, some kind of clerical clothing or even military clothing, then his intention corresponds to his uniform. And the uniform speaks for him. If he has money, he has it in a legal and very honest way. If he promises us favors, it comes from his sympathetic kindness, etc. He says, we as little children, we judge the inside by appearance only. By their words, their clothes, by articles in a newspaper, and especially by their promises, by personal compliments, and by handouts. With that kind of mentality, they don't even need to camouflage themselves to a great extent. But just like trying to discover who has aristocratic standing and who doesn't, trying to figure out what actual evil is, and who either evil on the one hand or just flawed on the other. Evil grows out of the soul and the heart. It remains internally festering. Good or evil carries us through our life. And you can see it. You hear it in the intonations of voice. It glances, our manners, turns the speech, argumentation. It eventually will betray us. Some people can be betrayed by a simple glance, one word, one question. Beyond that, words have to be connected to deeds. You can't judge by speech. You can only judge by deeds alone. There's a right to words that we utter, that they have a right to be investigated, or really an obligation, that flowery words can't cover up previous evil. Great slogans don't come from the mouth of a traitor, because his actions then would not connect to his words. You have to be blind and deaf to believe in the sincerity of a hireling. And our generation is so rich in this aberrant experience, we have to have this sense of evil. Someone who is writing or speaking like I am has to, despite all of our mistakes and sins, can't be a hypocrite. Remember what a hypocrite is. Hypocrite is not someone who is inconsistent. We're all inconsistent. A hypocrite is someone who doesn't believe what they say. A politician addressing a certain group, telling them what they want to hear. That's what they mean. Someone who is gaining something by the virtue signalers. That's flattery. That's the bribery of words. But what does he say to do? One of the first things he does is don't get involved in these personal slander, the political intrigue, the petty gossip. maintain everything at the level of principle to the extent possible. And he also says to close your ranks. It's a persistent, it's a tireless and thankless task to find people who you can absolutely trust and make sure that you know that you're not just trying to find reasons to trust them, that you actually can trust them. People in desperate straits need to have someone not be evil, because it makes them look bad, if that's the case. If they're dependent and desperate, they have to believe it. And they'll tell themselves and rationalize anything. And to look into evidence, to look into, to actually know how to think clearly. And over time, I mean, we're at an age now where people are far more amenable to understanding what evil is. You don't have much of an excuse anymore. Integrity means coming from a single source. That you have one personality in all circumstances. You have one set of principles in all circumstances. You're not one person at work, one person in court, one person with your family. That's not even a person. That's a series of masks that you wear. And this is one of the big reasons, big ways you can tell the good from the evil. If you remove self-interest, now, and Elon says this elsewhere, but I'm adding it here. If you remove your own personal self-interest from any circumstance, finding the truth is not very difficult. We get fooled, usually because we want to get fooled. Outside of just simply being naive, we're fooled because we need to believe that a certain person is good. It's so hard to think that your mother is evil. It's so hard to think that parents don't love their children. It's so hard to think that politicians that you respect may really be dishonest. We want to believe that. You can't worry about what might happen as a result. You speak the truth, and if you suffer, you suffer. That's just a matter of self-interest there. You get rid of that, which is what he's talking about by civic courage and integrity. It's not that hard to spot the evil. We're fooled because we want to be fooled. And this was the last thing he says, how to tell a sincere from an insincere person. Experience and leaning on experienced people. Experience comes down to knowing in your gut how to tell. Even Heidegger talks about this attunement. You kind of just know. It's this collected experience. It's a turn of phrase, a certain glance that take one from another. Third parties are absolutely essential because they're not in the thick of it all. Ultimately, experience rather than ideology is a central idea. And remember that you don't know everything. You may be intelligent. You may be knowledgeable in a certain area, but you need third parties. There needs to be a basic consensus. And that consensus has to be based on people who actually are aristocratic. They have to be able to defend their positions rationally, not appeal to emotions. I never found discerning evil from good all that difficult. The only time it becomes difficult is when you're very closely connected with somebody, family member or whatever. Then we don't want to believe this stuff. I had a few more things, but we may get to that some other time. That's the foundations of Ivan Illin's practical political science. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.